This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. A bit later in the hour, we're going to talk to two video game designers who are pushing the boundaries of what you can feel. What do you feel playing a video game? Amy and Ryan Green will talk about their game, That Dragon Cancer. But first, what's the one universal expression that cuts across cultures? Turns out it's the I don't think so face. You know, imagine your boss asking you to stay late tonight and say, I don't think so. It's that one. And Rachel Feldman puts the face on that story and other selected short subjects in science. She's editor of the Speaking of Science blog for the Washington Post. I don't think so, Rachel.
Yeah, so scientists are calling it the not face. And it's a combination of the expressions you see for anger, disgust, and contempt. And the reason they were interested in the not face is that they thought that it might actually be a kind of grammatical marker. Now, when we talk about human language and how it's different from other communication in other animals, a lot of times scientists come back to grammar. There's some research that shows that birds might use grammar, but it's really nowhere else in the animal kingdom. And so we're always looking for the origins of that. And scientists thought that this facial expression, which kind of is your response to directly negating whatever was just said, might be more than just emotional expression. It might actually be used to kind of punctuate your sentence. And when they looked at different speakers making this face, you know, while they answered a question that appalled them, they found that it was universal. And more importantly, they found that people using American Sign Language sometimes dropped the sign for not and used the facial expression as the only indicator that the sentence was negative.
So there is an expression
right. For
that face in sign language.
Well, just instead of signing that they thought that was a bad idea, you know, they would be signing their thoughts. And instead of using the not, they were using the not face.
Uh-huh.
So they think that, you know, that's a pretty good indication that this connection they thought was there is there. And they're actually going to go through YouTube videos and do big data analysis to try to find more faces that are, you know, woven into language this way.
Is there a universal yes face?
Well, if there is, it's not as easy to spot as the not face, but they're hoping they'll find it.
That's interesting that so much information can be conveyed and that it is so universal
around
the world. Let's move on to last month. We were watching an asteroid that could have come close to the Earth, but a space rock did slam into Jupiter 2 weeks ago.
Yeah. So the cool thing about this story is that we wouldn't know about it if it wasn't for a couple of amateur astronomers. A video from Austria was brought to the attention of Phil Plait over at Slate, and it was just someone in their backyard with a telescope watching Jupiter and seeing this flash that looked like it might be an impact. But it's hard to look at one video and say what it is, no matter what. So he put out a call for other videos, and it turned out an amateur astronomer near Dublin had picked up the same thing. So based on what they recorded, it seems pretty likely that a comet or asteroid hurled into Jupiter. And it was probably actually really small based on, you know, flashes that have been observed previously. It was probably only about 30 feet across. But because Jupiter's gravity is so powerful, the velocity of anything hitting it is huge. And the impact energy would have been 25 times what it would have been for the same object to hit Earth.
It was like over 100,000 miles an hour.
Right. Hitting. Just like incredible gravity, incredible velocity. You know, so that's how you get a relatively small rock creating a flash that somebody could see with their telescope here.
You know, when I read this story, it reminded me of a story we did back in 1994 when the comet Shoemaker-Levy 9 was going to slam into Jupiter also. That was going to be a big event. And actually, is another amateur astronomer, Levy. We had David Levy come on the show and anticipate for us what was going to happen.
It's not the size of the special effects that really matters here. It is to look out for all the surprises, all of the unknowns. This is going to be the largest campaign for a single event in the history of astronomy.
And it left a pretty big scar.
It did.
For a while.
Yeah, the comet broke up into, I want to say, 22 pieces.
Right.
But a lot of those pieces left scars. They They changed Saturn's ring a little bit. There are atmospheric effects that they can still see today.
It was very interesting. A few months ago, we talked about a theoretical alien megastructure that could be surrounding a distant star. Aliens. And then, you know, the odds were it could be just as easily be an alien as anything else. And now scientists have come up with a hypothetical alien laser protection system?
Yes. So most of the time when we do these weird thought experiments about aliens, it's about how to find aliens. But this one, you know, says, what if we want to hide from aliens, which is a big ongoing debate that we won't get into. The idea is that, you know, our detection of planets that could host life all relies on transiting planets. They pass in front of their star from our perspective, and they change the star's light. They make the star flicker dim. And we use that to learn about the planet. So the idea is, if other planets are looking at us that way, how could we hide the fact that our planet was passing in front of the sun? And we could do it with a laser. This study calculated how much power it would take, and they came up with I think at 30 megawatts a year for 10 hours, just, you know, that one burst to hide the transit. It would take significantly more power to hide every wavelength of light that the sun puts out. That would just hide visible light. But you could use a little less and just kind of mask the presence of life on Earth. You could make it look like Earth was just kind of an atmosphericless dead rock.
An atmospheric dead rock sending out a laser beam.
Yeah. So the problem here is that it's assuming that this intelligent life wouldn't have a better or at least very different way of looking at our planet. It's possible that this laser would have nothing to do with how they were detecting us. We could also use, you know, the same principle to make our signal even louder. You know, while we were transiting, we could make these weird flashes, you know, a la alien megastructure, and try to get their attention. But it also raises the possibility that aliens might be hiding from us using lasers because of how terrible we are. So I found that a little depressing.
Anything's possible. They're hiding from us, you know. But anyhow, thank you, Rachel.
Thank you.
Fascinating stories, as always. Rachel Feldman, editor of the Speaking of Science blog for The Washington Post. And now it's time to play Good Thing, Bad Thing. Because every story has a flip side. Well, if you're in traffic right now, imagine going for a drive and never having to stop for a light, never having to wait for that guy making the left turn. You know who I'm talking about. Never needing to come to a complete stop at the intersection. It's a possible future in a world of autonomous vehicles all signed into a system that would coordinate their movements at intersections. Think of air traffic control like they do for planes, control where they are. They would do that for merging vehicles. Joining me now to talk about the good and bad of autonomous intersections is Evan Ackerman, contributing editor at IEEE Spectrum. Welcome back.
Hey, good to see you, Raya.
So how would these work? Is it very much like air traffic control, but for cars?
Yeah, it's almost exactly the same. So the idea here is that if you have autonomous cars that all communicate with intelligent intersections, then it would make intersections work a lot like an airport. So your car will talk to the intersection over the internet and say something like, hey, intersection, I'm approaching from this direction and I'm going this fast and I'd like to pass straight through you in 10 seconds. And then it'll be the intersection's job to coordinate with all of the other cars that are talking to it to make sure that right when your car shows up, there'll be a gap in the traffic just large enough for you to squeeze through safely.
So what's the good thing about this?
Well, the good thing is that hypothetically, we'll be able to get rid of stop signs and get rid of traffic lights and just get rid of all of that annoying waiting around that we have to do at intersections right now. All of it could just go out the window. Intersections would just be something that you pass straight through. And MIT has these really cool simulation videos of this happening. And honestly, they're kind of scary to watch because you've got this intersection where cars are passing through from four different directions and cars are turning across lanes and they're all weaving in and out and barely even slowing down. And somehow none of them hit each other. And it's probably going to be terrifying for us to go through this, but you'll never have to stop. And that's going to be great.
So what could be bad about this?
Well, the first thing is that it doesn't really work unless all of the cars going through the intersection are autonomous. And so that's got to happen first, because a car driven by a human is going to be by far the most dangerous thing on the road in a world of autonomous cars. And if you have a human driven car trying to go through this intersection, it would just mess it up completely. And the other obvious problem is that this doesn't really take into account all the other ways that intersections are used. So you've got pedestrians trying to cross the street, you've got people on bikes, stuff like that. And at the moment, autonomous intersections don't really know how to deal with that sort of thing, even in simulation.
So what's the advantage over this over individual cars talking to each other without a central system?
It's much more efficient to have the intersection controlling everything. It's also more reliable because the intersection kind of has this big overview of everything that's happening. And when you have the intersection in control, you can actually get cars to cooperate with each other more effectively. You form them into these little platoons, and they go through the intersection in groups, and that's a lot more efficient than just one at a time.
Now, what if you created this right as you start your trip from home, and you program where you want to go? Would it control all the other cars that, you know, are on the road too? And would people put up with that? Hey, maybe I have to go a little longer.
Well, it's the researchers did some simulations of exactly how much you'd have to kind of adjust your speed in order to get all of this to work. And it's really not that much. You maybe slow down slightly when you approach intersections to give other people time to get through. But it's so much better than having to stop completely that, you know, you're going to save maybe a minute or two per intersection. And the worse traffic gets, the more time you'll save.
Now, some of those folks with road rage, 10 seconds is too long. Thank you, Evan. Evan Ackerman is a contributing editor at the IEEE Spectrum. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, we're going to talk about the emotional side of video games. Can a game make you cry or laugh? The new ones can, and they're quite interesting and emotional to play. We'll talk about it right after this short break. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. I played a couple of video games yesterday, and they made me very emotional, sad, and depressed. Not because I lost the games. In fact, these games are not about losing or winning, or how many bad guys you get to shoot. These games are designed to evoke feelings in you. And while these kinds of games are becoming more widespread, the idea is not new. Back in the 80s, the video game company Electronic Arts published a recruitment ad for computer game designers, and the ad asked, quote, "Can a computer make you cry?" It was a challenge to all those young game designers out there to start thinking a little differently about what games could do and how a game could make you feel. Can a computer game make you cry? My next guest says, absolutely. It can also make you laugh, maybe even get you to empathize with somebody, feel their grief or their joy. Catherine Isbister is a professor of computational media at the University of California, Santa Cruz. Her new book is called How Games Move Us. And in it, she gives us a peek into the game designer's toolbox. How do you create games that touch our emotions? Catherine Isbister, welcome back to Science Friday.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
You say we're in the middle of a gaming renaissance. Explain what you mean by that.
Well, in the last few years, there's been the ability to more easily distribute games online and on things like your iPhone, and the tools that people use to make games have gotten cheaper. In fact, a lot of them are even free now, believe it or not. So there's been a flood of amazing new developers creating all kinds of interesting game experiences that we can just download with the click of a button.
What is the big difference between playing a game from reading a book or watching a movie?
Well, the fundamental thing about games is you come into it knowing that you're going to have to be active. You're going to have to make choices, and that's the expectation of the player. Whereas when you open a book or, you know, tune into a movie, you're expecting to sit back and be entertained by the experience, to be swept away by the narrative. And that means that games can do different things emotionally for people.
Yes. Let me talk about a couple of these games. A lot of games you write about put you in someone else's shoes, like a game I played this week called Papers, Please. It puts you in the shoes of a border guard, basically.
Yes, an unlikely hero, I suppose. How did you enjoy that?
You know, it gets more complex. You're basically stamping visas, whether someone can come into your country, And then it gets harder and harder. You have to start making ethical choices about
Absolutely.
Things. And you don't, you know, there are no ethical choices when you're playing shoot 'em up games.
Well, sometimes there are, but not in that. I guess I would say Papers, Please, you know, it really gets you. The devil's in the details, so to speak. You don't often think of empathizing with somebody who's in that job. Normally, you're on the other side of the window being annoyed or a little bit fearful as you travel between countries.
Mm-hmm. Was there any impetus for this change in the way games are being created now? Is there a, can you point to any one game that said, this was the father or the mother of all these new games?
Oh, that's a great question. I don't really have one in mind. There's just been an explosion of these different games. There is one game that was a real breakaway game in the last couple of years for the way that it put multiple players into this kind of situation, and that game was Journey.
Mm, yeah. How does that game work?
So Journey is a game. It's actually, you play it on the PlayStation, which is one of these living room consoles. And you go into the game, and unlike many sort of superhero-oriented video games, you're just a little person in robes. You're tiny in contrast with this huge landscape, and you're wandering around trying to figure out what to do. And then at some point in the game, you come across another little figure like yourself. And the funny thing about this game, most games, it's easy to chat or even, you know, get on a voice line with other players that you encounter in the game. But with this game, you can't talk to each other. You have to use these little chirping noises and do little sort of pantomime in game to figure out, you know, where you should go and what you should do together. And I think the creators of that game company, basically distilled down almost a poem of interaction between the two players so that you have to watch very closely and coordinate very closely with that person. And there's certain things that you absolutely can't do in the game unless you're working together. And so it creates this incredible feeling of camaraderie with someone that you're never going to know who they are.
Yeah, and what about that? Why is it that you never find out who your travel partner is? Is it does it matter?
Well, that was an intentional design choice, and I think, like many choices in Journey, the idea is to get you to reflect on the essence of connection and cooperation, and that it doesn't have to boil down to knowing a ton of details about someone or, you know, making judgments about whether they're like you or not. Mm. That you can work together and form an intimate connection without all those things.
You know, it's a beautiful game. I was playing it. I was watching the video, the YouTube of it last night, and I said, you know, what happens if I just mirror this to my big screen TV off my mm-hmm. laptop? Whoa, it just becomes a whole different experience. And maybe some of these games are being designed because we know all these big screen TVs are out there.
Absolutely. I think people have gotten much more sophisticated about thinking about where the game's going to be played, who's going to be playing it with them, who's looking over their shoulder. I don't know if you know, but there are many, many game design programs now in universities, and it really is a renaissance time for developing games as an art form.
Now, so far we've talked about games that are, you know, mystical or sort of leave you with a bad emotional feeling, but there are games that make you happy, make you want to dance. You know, there's a game called Just Dance or Rock Band.
Yes, yes, yes. There are games that are expressly for having fun with your friends and being goofy. There are now games that get you into a meditative state, you know, games that get you to explore a fanciful world and interact with creatures that, you know, wouldn't exist anywhere but in your imagination. It's pretty impressive, the range.
And how does adding movement change the mood of the game?
Right. So I'd say in the last maybe 5 years, there's been all of these motion-based controllers that have come out for video games. And what that means is you can physically move your body as you're playing. One of the things about how we learn about how we feel is we notice how we feel partly through how we're moving. So if a game gets you to jump up and down as if you're really excited, that in essence tricks your brain into thinking, oh, wow, I guess I was really excited. I wonder what he's excited about, and can completely cause you to, you know, reframe what's happening right mm-hmm. in front of you. So game designers can use this to cause people to feel all kinds of interesting feelings more deeply than they might just sitting in front of the screen.
Yeah. Let me see if I can get a quick call in from Brandon in Waterloo, Iowa. Hi, Brandon.
Hi there.
Hi there.
I wanted to comment about two games here. One of them is Kerbal Space Program, and the other one is The Last of Us. And those are just two radically different games. Kerbal Space Program was endorsed by NASA with their asteroid redirect mission, and that actually educated me so I can understand orbital mechanics. Excuse me.
Huh.
Orbital mechanics and other aspects of spaceflight that I just never saw until I saw it on a screen with Vision. And then The Last of Us is a radical emotional roller coaster ride. I actually was just getting a little bit emotional thinking about it. Not to spoil anything, but to feel what it's like to have a daughter or something like that, for me as a gay man, is a very deep and intrinsic that something I may not experience.
Oh, that's a very good thank you, Brandon, because that's a very good segue into my next part of this segment. I want to add two more voices to the conversation. Ryan and Amy Green are video game designers, and their game is called That Dragon Cancer, and it is something completely new to gaming. We asked whether a game could make you cry. Well, that Dragon Cancer is a game where you experience what it's like to care for a very young child with terminal cancer. Ryan and Amy's son Joel passed away in 2014, and That Dragon Cancer shares his story, and it will make you emotional. Ryan Green and Amy Green, welcome to Science Friday, and thank you for this game.
Thank you.
Well, I'm going to ask you the question everybody wants to ask: why did you make this game?
Oh, sometimes I just think, what else would I have done? I think, for Amy and I, we're creative people, and we're, expressing what we were going through always seemed like a natural thing to us. I think even Joel's illness kind of thrust us into living out this battle with cancer in public. And so through a blog and through sharing art on the blog and sharing our thoughts on the blog, mm-hmm. That kind of set the stage for us looking for other ways that we can share that. And I'm a video game designer, and Amy's a writer, and so it seemed like a natural expression.
Yeah. And we realized there was something really intriguing about, as the parents of a child with terminal cancer, all you want is to have a choice you could make that would fix the situation, and you don't have that, and it's really frustrating. And we realized that video games are a medium where the player expects to have choices and expects to be able to make the right choice. And so that was something that was really interesting to explore.
This is more like storytelling than actually playing a game, isn't it? We're watching you go through the life of you and your child.
Yeah, it's kind of an invitation to bear witness to our life, and an invitation to sit with us in those intimate moments of, whether it be being alone in the hospital room with Joel and taking care of him, or sitting with us and playing with Joel, taking care of him while we receive some really hard news from the doctors. And so in that way, we've given you permission into these intimate moments.
What does a game let you do that a film or a book wouldn't? Why did you decide to tell Joel's story in a game rather than write something about it?
Well, I think one amazing thing that video games do is they let the player be a part of the story. Their presence matters to the story. And that was something we wanted to give people. Certainly people have written a lot about what it's like to lose someone you love, and we've seen that on film, but a video game felt like a way to invite someone to actually be mm-hmm. in that space with us.
Well, one of the first experiences we made in this game was a recreation of a night I spent in the hospital, where I felt very desperate because Joel was sick and he was crying and he was dehydrated and I couldn't comfort him. And so no matter what I would do, I couldn't get him to stop crying. And in that moment of desperation, being at the end of myself, crying and praying and just asking for peace, that's when Joel found peace. And that was a moment of grace that I experienced. And so I think video games are a really beautiful expression of grace, because you can only do what the game designer allows you to do. And so in that way, if the player is brought through an experience where no matter what they do, they can't solve the problem, that is a direct reflection of that frustration that I felt. And I think in that space, they can also experience the grace that I felt in that moment.
Yeah. Catherine, I know you've played That Dragon Cancer. What about the experience? What about it struck you most?
Well, I think this is an excellent example of walking that line between control for the player and control for the designer. And I think that the game really does use that tension to get the player to experience that frustration, and it's a double layer frustration, right? It's a frustration of, I wish I could do more as a player. And then it's like, that's exactly how these parents were feeling. And you get to experience that feeling in the now that was experienced in the past. And that's a very different way of empathizing with people than we would have in with, say, a film.
Mm-hmm. We're talking about game playing this hour on Science Friday from PRI Public Radio International. I'm Ira Flato. We're talking with Amy Green and Ryan Green, who have put a game together called That Dragon Cancer, which if you don't get a little misty playing this game, there's something wrong with you. It really is very, very powerful. And I want to play a little bit of a new documentary called Thank You for Playing, which follows you, Amy and Ryan, as you create That Dragon Cancer. And just to set the scene for everybody, Amy, you're sharing an idea for a scene with Ryan.
I know that you don't want too many elements of, like, real gameplay in the game, but I would love if in this scene the player, like, gets to where they're actually having fun in this, and they have a moment of, like, I was having fun in the middle of this cancer game. People going through grief have to do that anyway.
Amy, tell us about that. Why was that important for you?
You know, it was important because I think people think of raising a child with cancer is just this one-note experience, that it's all terrible and it's all sad and it's all horrible. And there are certainly days when we got terrible news with Joel that were some of the worst days of my life, but there were also these beautiful, fun, exciting days with Joel. There was this aspect of loving him so much more because I realized how precious his life was. And there were also, you know, long periods of time where, you know, just not much was happening, and you could almost forget that he had cancer and that you weren't just a family like everyone else. And I wanted the player to be able to get caught up in a moment where they're just having a good time and having fun, and then maybe wondering if that's okay, because there were certainly moments when Joel was sick and even after Joel died where our life felt pretty normal, and then you had to kind of evaluate, is that acceptable?
Yeah, I think one of the things in the hospital is that I felt like, you know, there's a video game console. Should I, as a father, play that video game, or should I be taking care of Joel at all times? And I think that sometimes we maybe have to give ourselves permission to laugh. We have to give ourselves permission to care for ourselves and to have fun with each other, because play was the way that I interacted with Joel. Play is the way that I could show love to Joel and that we could have connection.
Some of our tweet friends are coming in, where Ryan Thompson says, a game To the Moon really got to me. It's an examination of mental illness and disability. Hit close to home. Not the typical emotional experience as Bash, but Shadow of the Colossus made me feel the sting of betrayal. Those who finish it know it. I want to play another little cut we have from Thank You for Playing here, and I'll set this one up. Here's Ryan. Here's you talking with one of your designers about how to create an avatar for Joel.
Like, if we could create, like, a little avatar that is cute, you know?
Like we've talked about before, so often facial expressions are just hard to convey in a game.
Dead eyes and waxy faces. I mean, we could also try, like, no nose, no mouth, no eyes, and just have eyebrows or something.
I wonder if people would see that character, like, with the audio and stuff, if their brain would fill it in and they would be, like, they're imagining the face, you know?
Yeah, Joel, Ryan, what does Joel's avatar look like in the game? He really doesn't have a face, does he?
Yeah, for much of Joel's life, he lost his hair. And so in that way, we have a small character that is the shape of Joel and the head shape of Joel and has ears, but there is no face. And what we found is that actually allowed people to connect more with our characters. Because even though we don't have faces on our characters, they're still recognizable as us and they're still hearing our voices. And so I think in the same way that radio allows you to paint a picture for your listeners through audio, you know, our video game was able to have the same effect and kind of play to the strengths of audio and radio, but also the expressionism and impressionism of a video game.
We're going to take a break, and when we come back, we're going to continue our conversation with Catherine Isbister and Ryan and Amy Green about the emotional side of gaming. Our number 844-724-8255. You can also tweet us at SciFry. Stay with us. We'll be right back after this break. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatto. We're talking this hour about gaming and how playing a game can make us feel, make us emotional. My guests are Ryan and Amy Green, creators of the powerful new video game, That Dragon Cancer. The game tells the story of their toddler's son Joel's battle with cancer. Catherine Ispister, author of the new book, How Games Move Us. She's a professor of computational media at the University of California, Santa Cruz. Our number, 844-724-8255. More tweets coming in. Allie Hunter says, Brothers, A Tale of Two Sons is such a moving game. I almost regret playing it. I was sad for days afterwards. That is...
Wow.
That is certainly something. Let's go to John in Tucson. Hi, welcome to Science Friday.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I just want to make a comment and add to what we've been talking about so far. So I just want to mention the soundtrack and music to games have evolved so much. You mentioned the game Journey and also another game like Bioshock and also The Legend of Zelda. The music is no longer just beeps and clicks from Atari consoles, but they're full orchestral arrangements that are played now just by themselves. And I'll take my comment off the air. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. And Catherine?
Yeah, that's absolutely right. I mean, that was a close collaboration for that game company. I believe it was Austin Wintory who did that composition for the game, and I think it made a big difference.
Mm-hmm. Ryan and Amy, how did you get your game done? I mean, you didn't go to Electronic Arts or Activision or any of the really big players, did you?
Well, actually, early on, we did. We took a demo of our game to the Game Developers Conference, and that's where it's like a conference of our peers, and you know, looking for anybody that might be interested in helping us get this made. And we did meet with some very large publishers. In the end, a smaller publisher called Ouya, which is another one of those television consoles, picked us up and helped provide the initial set of funding for us. Eventually, we also went to Kickstarter, which is a crowdfunding platform where other people can support us, and we were able to raise the money we needed to finish the game.
Mm-hmm. So how do people find your game? Are they experienced gamers or, you know, just searching?
Yeah, I mean, right now, the first platform we released on is on the computer, so PC and Mac, through a storefront called Steam. And that is kind of a place where thousands of PC games can be purchased. And so, you know, we're working on bringing it to other platforms, and we hope to be able to do that.
Mm-hmm. Catherine, do you find that most of the small games, these games are slowly gaining traction, and maybe someday they'll be picked up by the big game makers?
Well, I think that's the eternal challenge, right? So we have these wonderful platforms now like Steam and also, you know, the app stores. And you can get your game out there, but the thing is to get it to the right audience. And so I think it's great that you're doing a segment on this, because I think that there are a lot of really interesting, complex, mature experiences out there looking for that audience. And you know, people should go find these games.
And they become addictive. I mean, TV is dying for, I think, people can play these wonderful games on their big screen. Catherine, where do these games need to go from here, in your opinion?
Well, I think we're going to see a coevolution between the games and the audiences. I think, you know, any medium, the challenge is coming up with interesting genres that intersect with audiences who are ready and willing to experience those things. And I think that's the dance we're seeing now. Traditionally, you know, games had to be sold in a box in an electronics store, and that was a certain kind of customer, and only so many could be on the shelf. And, you know, we're in a really different world now. So I think we're going to see a continued expansion of the types of games that are out there. Mm-hmm. And the other thing that's just around the corner is all these virtual reality headsets, of course. And everybody's working in the design side to figure out what the most engaging and interesting experiences are in that medium. So I think that'll be quite interesting as well.
Yeah, that's going to be a game changer, so to speak. Let's go to Eau Claire, Wisconsin. Hi, welcome to Science Friday.
Hi.
Hi there. Go ahead.
Yeah, I just wanted to make comments about this game I had just played recently called Life is Strange. It's a 5-part series where you play this young female character who just recently discovers she can turn time back. And you have to follow her and make decisions on just about everything, and it really immerses you into the character. It makes you feel like you're playing and making these decisions on your own, and I feel like I'm a pretty masculine guy, and this game made me break down and spin ball.
Oh, you're crying.
Wow. Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, and that's one of the amazing things about games is that you really can step into another person, another race, another gender, another age, another species, and quite viscerally experience some of the things that, you know, they may be feeling.
What is it about the avatars that make us feel that way? I mean, what is the secret to making us feel that way, Ryan or Catherine? Amy, you can jump in too.
I think versus experiencing other media, I think video games are one of the few where you say, I did this. And so when you go on these adventures and you're making these decisions, it's you as the player that's doing it. And you may be role-playing or you may be yourself. And so in that regard, you know, in these settings, there's a profound sense of presence, of a sense of place, of being in there. And I think that it's easy to get lost in that.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's I was trying to compare it to like a three hanky movie, you know, when you're sitting and watching the movies. But it's a different emotion. You know,
yes.
In a movie,
yes.
You're just a passive watching it, and you're feeling bad for the character, but you feel you are the character.
Yes, in a movie, you get a pass because it's not your fault, but in a game, because the premise is that you get to take action, you get to make consequent decisions about what's happening. Things that do happen, they do feel like, you know, you've played a role in them for good or ill.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, we've had an experience where a player actually. We brought it to a show, and they stood up in the middle of the scene because there was a prompt to pray, and it's my character praying because I'm telling my story, and they got up and they said, I'm sorry, I can't keep playing because I don't pray. And I thought that was really profound, because how often in video games does our personal religious belief factor into the decisions that we're making in these video games? And to me, I found that to be very profound.
Wow. I don't think I can get any further after that. I want to thank both of you, all three of you, for taking time to be with us today. Catherine Isbister is a professor of computational media, UC Santa Cruz, and author of the new book, How Games Move Us. And it's a great book. There are a lot of great suggestions, Catherine, in that book.
Oh, glad you found it helpful.
I couldn't go fast enough through them. Amy and Ryan Green are two of the creators of the game That Dragon Cancer. It's a documentary about the making of That Dragon Cancer. It's available streaming now, and the film is called, that documentary, Thank You for Playing. And I want to thank all of you for being with us today.
Thank you very much for having us.
You're welcome.
It was great to be here.
Yeah, it was great to talk to you. If anybody wants to try any of the games we've talked about, we've got a beginner's guide to gaming up on our website. Plus, we have an excerpt of Catherine Isbister's book, How Games Move Us, and you can get your game on at sciencefriday.com/games. Each week in our editorial meeting, we sort of sort out dozens of journal titles. And after reading some of the headlines and abstracts, it's hard to tell sometimes if the researchers are pulling our leg. Did you hear the news that if you carry a shopping list, you're less likely to forget the items? Really? That's a study out this week in the Journal of Consumer Psychology. And to celebrate April Fool's Day today, Mark Abrams is here to play a game of Spot the Spoof Science Story. A science edition of Two Truths and a Lie. Mark is the editor of the Annals of Improbable Science and MC of the Ig Nobel Awards, of course. Welcome back, Mark.
Hi, Ira. Happy 1st of April.
Thank you. You too. You know, you have pulled together two studies that are outlandish but true, and one false study, completely made up. Are you ready to...
other way around. I'm not telling you how many of these are real and how many concocted.
Even better. Our audience can play this game. Anybody can play along. They can tweet us at SciFry and tell us which one they think is the fake study. So, Mark?
Or which two?
Which two are the fake studies? Okay. Go ahead. Okay, hit me.
First one is what you might call a scientific evaluation of a historic sea monster sighting. It's some scientists looking at something from long ago. It's a study called Cetaceans, Sex, and Sea Serpents, an analysis of the Agueda accounts of a, quote, most dreadful monster, that's the end of the quote, seen off the coast of Greenland in 1734. The scientists who wrote this are at the University of St. Andrews in Scotland, and one of them is in Norway, published in something called the Archives of Natural History. I'll read you a little piece of the paper's abstract. It says, a reevaluation of the most dreadful monster, originally described by the Apostle of Greenland, Hans Agueda, in 1741, suggests that the missionary's son, Poole, probably saw an unfamiliar cetacean. Okay, we know we're dealing here with whales and the like. The species seen was likely to have been a humpback whale or a North Atlantic right whale or one of the last remaining Atlantic gray whales, either without flukes or possibly a male in a state of arousal. That's okay. The first one.
Okay.
So
I'm
what they're
the
saying
picture on that.
Is that it was one of the according to this, one of the best known and most widely analyzed historic reports of a sea monster sighting that apparently, in the light of modern science, it was simply a whale with an erection.
Oh.
That's the first
okay.
one.
That's the
Ready
first
Ready for the
one.
Next one?
Yes.
Okay. The next one is an experiment on something that most people are familiar with, that it's well known that with most cats, if you were to turn the cat upside down and drop it, the cat is able to turn itself around and land on its feet. Okay? There was a paper in 1998 describing a series of experiments to determine the limits of a cat's ability to right itself when you turn it upside down and drop it. The scientist, it was at the Institute of Biophysical Research in Milan, Italy. This was published in the journal Biophysica Naturale, again in 1998. I'll read you a little piece from the paper. In this study, I dropped a cat upside down from various heights and observed whether the cat landed on its feet. The next section says, dropping a cat upside down from a height of 6 feet. I dropped the cat from a height of 6 feet. I did this 100 times. The cat always landed on its feet. Next section is headlined, dropping a cat upside down from a height of 5 feet. It says, I dropped the cat from a height of 5 feet. I did this 100 times. The cat always landed on its feet. Next section is headlined, dropping a cat upside down from a height of 4 feet. I dropped the cat from a height of 4 feet. I did this 100 times. The cat always landed on its feet. Okay, it goes on like that for a while. I'll read you the last couple. Dropping a cat upside down from a height of 2 feet. I dropped the cat from a height of 2 feet. I did this 100 times. The cat always landed on its feet. And the final entry is dropping a cat upside down from a height of 1 foot. I dropped the cat from a height of 1 foot. I did this 100 times. The cat never landed on its feet. Okay, that's the second
one. From 1 foot. It never landed on its feet.
Yeah.
Okay, let me remind everybody that we're playing a little game with Mark Abrams, editor of the Annals of Improbable Science. We're talking about which one of these stories, or one or two of them, are true or false on Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International.
Okay, so I was reading to you from the paper. That's what the paper says. The third one is what the scientists describe as an experiment in gender differences in psychology. This happened in 2003. There are two psychologists who wrote a study called Love in the Afternoon. In this study, they explained that their colleagues had failed to appreciate the importance of an earlier study they'd done, a study 14 years earlier, that described an experiment. The experiment they did in the earlier study was to see whether women and men respond the same way if a stranger walks up and asks them to have sex. Here are the two studies. The later one was called Love in the Afternoon. Russell D. Clark III and Elaine Hatfield wrote it, published in a journal called Psychological Inquiry, 2003. The earlier one is called Gender Differences in Receptivity to Sexual Offers, published in 1989. And I'll read you a little chunk of it. It says, in these experiments conducted in 1978 and 1982, male and female confederates of average attractiveness approach potential partners with one of three requests. Would you go out tonight? Or will you come over to my apartment? Or would you go to bed with me? The great majority of men were willing to have a sexual liaison with the women who approached them. Women were not. not one woman agreed to a sexual liaison. Many possible reasons for this marked gender difference were discussed. Okay, that's the third one. Now I've got three. Okay. So, Ira, which of those are genuine and which did I concoct?
Well, you know, I've seen old movies of cats being dropped, where that experiment done, and there are films of it, the cat, and they have a little background there so you can measure how far it was open. Not from 6 feet, though. I'm going to say then that that's a real one. And
okay, you're wrong. I made that up. We published that in the Annals of Improbable Research quite a while ago. Okay, how about the others?
I get three strikes, right? Zero for one.
Maybe.
I'm going to say that the whale with the erection is true also.
And that's correct.
That's right one. And I'm going to...
And also, the lead author on that won an Ig Nobel Prize, but for something else. Charles Paxton was the co-author of an earlier study called Courtship Behavior of Ostriches Towards Humans Under Farming Conditions in Britain.
Wow. And I'm going to say that the Love in the Afternoon is not a real paper because you said not one woman. It's got to be one woman who would have said yes, I would have thought so.
Ira, you're wrong.
I'm wrong.
It's genuine. It's genuine.
Okay, so I got one right. I'll give myself the booby prize. Thank you, Mark.
Hey, what one is better than zero?
Exactly. It's the loneliest number. Thank you, Mark.
Thanks, Ira.
Have a great April Fool's Day. Mark Abrams, editor of the Annals of Improbable Research and MC of the Ig Nobel Awards. Just a reminder, on the web this week, from our perspective here on Earth, the moon seems like a pretty calm neighbor, but get up close and personal. And an ever-changing landscape of violent geology unfolds. There's really interesting stuff on our website. Get a look for yourself at the scarred face of the moon at sciencefriday.com/moon. Interesting stuff there. Charles Berquist is our director, senior producer Christopher Intagliata. Our producers are Alexa Lim and Annie Minoff, Luke Raskin, our video producer, Rich Kim, our technical director, Sarah Fishman and Jack Horowitz, our engineers at the controls here at the studios of our production partners, the City University of New York. I'm Ira Flatow in New York. That is not an April Fool's, I hope. We'll see you next week.